Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 82.
82.
That's Italian, where I wish I was right now, eating a gelato.
Well, it's another rainy day in Brooklyn as we record this.
I don't know
if you can hear the pitter-patter of the raindrops in the background.
I like the rain, though, because it makes me feel like, okay, for not going outside.
Well, it's not like we're really still allowed outside. In New York, we are just entering phase one, which is at least the New York version of phase one, which is pretty much still everyone's day at home.
Yeah, it's confusing. It's like construction is now open, but then you can't really have any contractors or anyone in your, like if you live in an apartment. And there was like a thing we needed a plumber for, and it was a whole thing to get him to come into the building. And I was like, but it could cause a leak and then it would mess up the whole rest of the building. And that was how I got him in.
Yes. But, you know, things are still pretty intense here, as you know, as far as the climate and the cultural climate. And just a forewarning, Lindsay and I are going to speak as best we can about these topics. I know what we say might not be perfect, or, you know, if I say something correct, I hope people correct me and, you know, educate me. But I'm going to try to be honest and just straightforward with our thinking. But one thing we wanted to talk about was sort of the reaction that the Black Lives Matter protests have had on the theater community in New York. And we haven't seen it hit the circus community in the same way. The circus community has its own sets of challenges and issues and things they're good at and things they're bad at. But we've really seen a lot of people in the Broadway community come out and describe the ways in which Broadway is racist, the ways in which there's this systemic prejudice against Black people, whether it be on stage or off stage. And it's a very interesting moment we're living in. I think the main thing people will have seen that's going around is a post. What's the title of the post, Lens?
It's called We See You, and it's a Dear White American Theater.
Mm. So what's the gist of it?
Well, you know, as someone who has worked in the theater in New York for over 10 years, with an open heart and only the best intentions, like I can see a lot of where they're coming from. But I think it's a lot of generalizations, which I've heard that they're like going to be more specific in the coming weeks, which I'm very interested to hear. But the gist of it is basically like, it's a letter written from a community of BIPOC, which stands for Black, Indigenous, and People of Color Theater Makers. And they basically are just calling out a lot of issues that have been going on in theater in general for the past, you know, decade. And people know about it. And I don't think it's all necessarily racism problems, but it's a lot of just like, is that a good culture to be creating and promoting? Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of it is some racism, but it's calling out theater producers, theater
unions, owners,
artists, like artistic directors. It calls out kind of like how, you know, one thing that's a little always weird, because I did work in fundraising and non-profit theater, and part of that is having a lot of the artists that you have that season come to the gala or come to a fundraiser or meet the donors, and they call out like one little paragraph is, we have watched you hustle for local, federal, foundation, and private funding on our backs, only to redirect the funds into general operating accounts to cover your deficits from years of fiscal mismanagement. We see you. I mean, that's true. Like, that is true. I think they parade every artist out, but it's basically just a lot of people who signed it, and it started as maybe 20 playwrights.
But for sure, when they parade artists out, they definitely parading them in the sense that, like, look at the Black artists and the Latino artists we're working with. They're not for just sure. Saying, like, look at the artists we're working with.
No.
They're definitely trying to be, like, extra, like, showing proof in a way that they're good people. And one of the most interesting articles I read was by a Black playwright and performer and musician named Heathcliff Saunders.
It's titled, What I Think About When I Hear That Broadway is Racist.
And this, to me, really pulled apart the kinds of way race is used in the American musical, which I found totally fascinating. It's totally worth it. It's like a 10-minute read. He really goes into detail. But one of the things he touches on is this like post-racial casting, which is essentially where, you know, anybody on stage can be anybody, even when it's good. So Hamilton is post-racial, in a way Beyond Babel is post-racial, any of these kinds of things where you just blind cast people. And the one issue he brought up about that is that because it takes place essentially in a future or reality where we don't see race per se, it does nothing to confront actual racism in society because mm-hmm. we are sort of just creating imaginary worlds where it's not an issue. And of course you have on the one hand, the you want to see people of all types and backgrounds represented on stage. So anybody in the audience of all types and backgrounds can see themselves up there and relate to it. And also you can empathize with people who might be different from you in one way or another. But I also understand the idea of, you know, the other kind of musical that's not the imagined one is the one based on real world stuff. And usually real world musicals that have to do with African-American themes are very often based around slavery or other racial historical things that have happened in America. And in that way, they don't really tackle racism, and often they stereotype it or they tell it just from the example of the playwright. And he uses that famous catchphrase, write what you know. So even in that case, they're sort of writing what they know, which is a racist reality. And what he's sort of pushing towards and talks about what he wants to explore in his own writing is trying to write the current and the future that he wants. And you'd have to read it to really understand, you know, the detail of what I mean by that phrase. It's hard to articulate it quickly. One last thing he pointed out in his essay is the difference between black lives and black bodies. And that I think a lot of these theaters that sort of, you know, we're talking about are like, oh, look, we got all these bodies on stage. They're black, white. You know, I even in circus, Big Apple Circus used to say black, white, green, purple, yellow. It doesn't. That's the thing. To them, it's just colors of bodies rather than actually acknowledging that somebody who's black or somebody who is Latino or somebody who's any kind of minority has their own different experience in a way, just by only focusing on skin color and not the greater picture of, you know, who this person is, who the life is inside the body, is just a way for people to sort of wiggle around the issue.
I mean, I get that, but at the same time, I think you have to separate the onstage casting versus like offstage. Onstage actors are there to serve a role. It's not necessarily about like your background. It's just about, can you play the part? Are you good at it? And the creative team and the team of management behind the show, like that's different. That's like,
for sure,
you know, your point of view as a person is bringing something interesting to this creative team, or the way you pick which plays should exist in a season. And I think there's like the hard part about this, we see you movement, the white American theater, is that it's really started by a lot of actors and playwrights, and they have their own point of view as actors and playwrights, and haven't necessarily always also been on the backside of it all to see how hard it is to make theater in general. And I'm a little bit sympathetic towards these theaters that like are trying to raise money and get an audience
and actors on stage.
Right. And have the ability to produce these plays. I think they do it in the most like ethical, not about race way. No.
Probably depends on who and what organization.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm on the board of an organization called New Dramatists. And every year we pick a team blindly picks 7 to 8 playwrights every year, and we support them for 7-year residencies, and they don't have to do anything except write a play, write a musical, whatever they want to write. And it's not ever about producing any shows. So in that way, we don't ever have to sell tickets. We don't have to make sure that it's a balanced season for our audience that they'll like. And because of that, it's afforded New Dramatists to be very blind in the outcome of these playwrights in a really wonderful way. But a lot of theaters don't actually have that. They're thinking about their audience base and what they're going to like. And some theaters have really old white audiences, and they're going to like certain plays that a maybe younger, more diverse audience won't like. I mean, it's a whole very, very complex issue. The interesting thing is that it's being talked about, and I am very interested to see what is coming out.
I mean, I love reading everything that people are posting, even if I don't 100% agree with it. I feel like every time there's a real someone telling their own story or someone reacting to it or the comment section, I'm just eating up this comment. It's so interesting as a thing. One thing I also wanted to raise, because you basically said that the difference between onstage and offstage is how you create diverse, balanced creative teams. And as somebody, you and I, whose job it is to create creative teams, this is, I think, honestly harder to do in a practical, like, how to get it done sense than it is to do casting. Because casting, you can do an open call. You can say, everybody submit. We're looking for everybody.
Yes.
And then you sort of whittle that down through a process, and they might come in person and try stuff. More often, the process for hiring creative team members is you interview people one by one. So you offer it to the person you want the most. And then if they say no, you go to the next person, then you go to the next person, then you go to the next person. And the reason you don't do it like big, wide casting is because if you said, I want loads of people, you can burn relationships
with
people.
Big, wide casting?
Big, wide. What did I say, white? Yeah. If you do a big, wide, white casting, but a big, wide casting for creative team members, it's just different. And, you know, maybe actors should be approached that way. Maybe that's the answer to the acting, maybe some kind of answer. But the greater point is, you can more easily get trapped into picking a all-white creative team than I think you can a cast.
Well, the thing is, though, is as a former actor, you know, they have equity calls and you can get an appointment, and that's when you have an agent and you're a part of Equity, the union, and you get a time and you go. But for every show, you are also obligated to have an open call. So before I had an agent and was on my way to any sort of union, I would go to the open calls all the time, and anyone can go. And it's not like closed for just specific types of people. But in the casting, especially when I first was doing this about 10 years ago, it was like, this is very specifically what we're looking for: a white woman, a black woman, or, you know, someone who is Asian. And is that good? Is that bad? I don't know. According to this other article, it's maybe better to cast for race and not blind casting, because then you're not confronting it at all. But I mean, for Hamilton, there was issues that said no white people.
Yes. Well, Hamilton has a whole set of issues that if you wanted to go down Hamilton and race, you could. People literally had done hour long podcasts on Hamilton and race and if it's problematic or not. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you raise a good point. Maybe creative teams should be open, and we should be posting on websites like looking for lighting designers or looking for scenic designers. But what I found has happened is that they're actually very difficult to find creative team members who you trust, because your creative team is a collaborator with you and a director producer. While you have a slightly different relationship with actors, they're your collaborators, but you're also in charge of them in a different way, and you're corralling them in a different way. And we have found success in getting references from people we know. So we meet somebody and we say, hey, X person, who do you know who would be great at this? And we use those people's recommendations to grow our network. And one of these mornings you were saying, wouldn't it be great to have a website or some kind of resource where you could see different people of color, just anybody with different backgrounds, a list of, you know, their credits, where they're at, how to contact them, like their references. And my first reaction to that was like, oh, I don't know, because, you know, in the 2000, the Mitt Romney Obama election, Mitt Romney got in a lot of trouble for saying, I have binders full of women, to prove like I'm going to hire women. I got binders full of them. Like, I don't want to be like, oh, we got binders full of non-white creative team members. But it is helpful to have it as a resource if the goal is, let's make these creative teams.
Right. Well, especially if the people you're going to are referencing people that they know who, and they don't know, they know a specific group of people as well. You know, it's also goes to the like greater issue, I think, of the fact that like with circus and with theater, the ability for kids to be a part of those things when they're young is key, and it's expensive, and you have to like be in the area that has a good school. And I mean, this goes back to even education in general for kids. I mean, there's an amazing documentary that I keep telling everyone to watch. It's 10 years old. It's amazing. It's called Waiting for Superman, and it's about the school system problem. And I watched it and was like, oh my God, my eyes are open to just like by where you live, put you on the trajectory of education. And I think like also with theater and circus, like where you live and what your family can afford for you puts you on a trajectory of the arts or not.
I do that distinction between theater and circus. One thing one of these writers pointed out was how theater naturally uses people for other roles. So if you're an actor, you are being used in service of somebody else's vision, somebody else's words, somebody else's direction. In circus, not all the time with contemporary circus, but at least often with contemporary circus and almost always with classical circus, it's basically whatever the performer is, it's Josh Avner on stage juggling, and we're celebrating that Josh can juggle these many objects. Mm-hmm. And we're not pretending Josh is somebody he's not. You saying words that aren't his own, you know, being told to move in a way by somebody else. And in that way, circus doesn't fall totally into that trapping. Circus falls into the other trapping of stereotyping, and you see like, oh, look, it's the group from Africa, and mm-hmm. you hear the African song and they're wearing African clothes. And, you know, as we learned from the P.T. Barnum story, they're actually not from Africa. They're from the South. And it's mm-hmm. just, you know, you're cladding them in that to appeal to white audiences. So it's a different kind of problem. And, you know, one thing that I've seen my friends have, you know, asked me to talk about, because nobody else is doing it, is racism in Cirque du Soleil. And that, you know, basically almost all the black characters in Cirque du Soleil shows are the villain. You know, they're not the villain the way like, I mean, they're Cirque du Soleil shows. So what story is there really for a villain? But kind of the menacing kind of characters are almost always black. And all of, you know, the heroic characters are, you know, white or Asian. Race and all of the and circus in Canada and the specifics of what it's like in Quebec, I can't really speak to. It's obviously a little different from race in America, but I would be interested in hearing stories or seeing somebody else sort of pull apart, you know, the issues with race in Cirque du Soleil. I mean, Joe Pinzon actually did a decent amount of that about his own experience being gay and Asian and trying to get gigs with Cirque du Soleil and the way in which what they are looking for sets some kind of standard. But that is its own sort of that's the thing also, like, can we have this conversation where we say it's about race in general, or is the conversation we're meant to be having right now really about, you know, the way racism impacts black people in the showbiz? And I'm okay to have both conversations. I feel like the latter is really the focus of it, mm-hmm. but it seems hard to have the latter and then not also have the broader conversation.
Well, one theater that I used to work for, they have a smaller stage space, and there's the main stage and the smaller stage. And what I always found interesting was, you know, they kept the smaller stage for shows that they thought would be harder to sell tickets to. And normally that would be new playwrights, because I get it. It's harder to sell tickets to a new play by a new playwright. I mean, a lot of this is also like how you sell tickets in marketing. And they choose
David Mamet's last name on it. You can just sell tickets based off of the playwright because he's got this huge history
of course. Or, you know, and we were talking with a friend the other night, like there was a playwright who wrote Witness Uganda or The Invisible Thread. And he's a young black guy. And the way in which he was treated by the artistic director and director of his show at ART was maybe different than she would have treated a more established playwright. And, you know, someone like Lynn Nottage, who's a older woman, black playwright, who's very established and very well-known.
Pulitzer Prize winning.
Right. May not have the same experiences at her age now in her career as this guy is having.
But maybe she is,
you know, and that's the whole thing. But this smaller stage space, also, it's usually where it's like the Latino playwright or the black playwright.
Or the Muslim playwright.
You know, and I think that is interesting when I think about it, because I never really thought about it.
No, it's the British and Irish, you know, who...
Main stage.
We love all the English work. And Lynn Nottage. You know. And we put it on the main stage.
It's really interesting, but the idea of like, is this just a conversation about black people in the theater, or is it about Asians, Latinos, Indian, everything, you know, other than just plain old white people, which is, you know.
And certainly white people aren't the only racist people. Just throwing that out there. No. Like, there are people who are in these powers of structure who aren't white, who are still being racist.
Right.
Not that it really matters.
But they're sexist. And like, you know, I mean, it's a whole thing. It's like... there's people who are assholes and people that are not. And the people that are assholes.
The tricky one is the people who don't know they're assholes. That's
true.
That's what hopefully this whole thing will help people who don't know they're assholes realize.
Yeah.
You might be being an asshole.
That's true. That's true. Because I think you can not be an asshole and make bad choices and do.
And not even know you did it.
Right. And do things like maybe you shouldn't have. But if you're a good person, hopefully you can recognize that and move on. But
I think it's, make amends.
Right. But it's the assholes who don't know they're assholes who are like, well, I'm a good person. And I would never do it. I'm like, but you did do that. You are doing that. You know, and I think those are the tricky people. Right? And the people who are assholes, I think, don't care. Don't really care.
Certainly the assholes who know they're assholes don't care.
But, it'll be interesting to see where we go in the next few weeks.
And we'll keep you, you know, abreast of that conversation, or at least the one that, you know, Lindsay and I are having amongst ourselves and reading online. So first half of this podcast, quite heavy. Second half of this podcast is going to be incredibly light and fun for you to listen to. We have a really awesome guest. Her name is Jenny Vidbell. She's a third generation circus performer, animal trainer. Most people have probably seen her in Big Apple Circus. She trains dogs and horses and llamas and pigs and loads of different kinds of animals, mostly on the domesticated side, not like big cats or anything like that. But she's truly such an interesting person. Listening to her talk about relationships with humans and animals and what it takes to sort of develop that bond and be on stage and live that life and have that lifestyle is really great. We recorded this episode with her 2 years ago, almost maybe a year and three quarters. It was sort of in our like back catalog. And at first, I didn't release it because I had a lot of trouble getting the audio to sound right. It sounds actually pretty good now. You'll hear a little bit of reverb on it, but we recorded it like in a semi-tented structure with animals in the background outdoors.
We recorded it mostly in the tent, in the Big Apple tent.
Mostly, but it was winter with the tent flaps open, and it's, you know, it sounds great now, but just know that this was from a different time and era, so we don't talk really about any current issues or anything happening.
But it's kind of nice because honestly, I'm getting overwhelmed by my social media feed and the heaviness of it all. And it's nice to see a video of just like a little dog dancing or something, you know. So this podcast hopefully will bring some just, you know, mindlessness, but loveliness to your day.
Something to let you disappear into fantasy.
And wish you were an animal trainer, because I definitely do.
Oh yeah, well you can hear it in the episode how much Lindsay loves Jenny and wishes she was Jenny. Before we let you listen to the podcast, just want to give a quick shout out to our friends at Circus Talk. They've recently launched a really interesting coronavirus page where it has lots of resources for different artists, whether that be grants or funding or how to stay healthy or how to train. And I know a lot of people are still at home, probably going to be home for a while longer. So I encourage you to go over there. Check them out, circustalk.com.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes or anywhere where you listen to podcasts, because we are now all over every site.
Spotify included.
Spotify included. And follow us on Instagram, Facebook us, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com with any thoughts, interesting topics. We love to hear them. And enjoy our podcast with Jenny Vidbell.
But my first question for you is, where are you from originally?
Upstate New York, in the Catskill Mountains.
In the Catskills. Yeah. And you're a multi-generation circus performer.
Third generation.
Yeah. Did you realize growing up that you came from an unusual sort of family or lifestyle, or did it all sort of seem normal to you?
I think that the beautiful thing about growing up in the circus is that nothing is abnormal, you know, like you're traveling all over the country. You're always exposed to different cultures, different people, different, you know, everything. And it's totally normal. And
were you traveling at like really, really young age all the time with circuses?
Oh yeah. I was 2-3 years old. I remember my grandparents had a hard time getting me to sleep if the truck wasn't running because the rattle. Yeah. We would sleep in the truck a lot. So
I saw that your grandparents met in Ringling.
Yes.
That's so cool. So your grandfather was an elephant trainer and your grandmother was a horse trainer.
Yes. Yeah.
And I love stories, especially in the circus.
Me too.
So cool. Yeah. So you grew up seeing them do their acts and train the animals.
Yes.
Did your parents, and your mom was a trainer too, right?
Yes. We're an animal family, except for my twin sister who, you know, was the black sheep of the family and decided to be an aerialist. So.
Oh, but she's still in the circus.
She's still in the circus, but that's big for an animal family, you know?
So did you ever get to take family vacations? I feel like that's one of the things to me about some people who must be animal trainers is that it's like a 365 kind of job. Like, I don't know how you can take meaningful like time off unless you have somebody you can trust to look after.
That's right. And it's very rare for me. I have one woman that I trust. She worked with me here at Big Apple for several years backing me up. She happens to be the wife of Rob Slowick, the band
leader.
So, it's basically up to her if I take a vacation. I'll call her and say, are you available? And if she's not, then I'm not going. And I'm really blessed to have her because I've never had that before. And it was never, you know, there was never an option for a vacation.
Were you always interested in training animals as a kid, or were you interested in something else and then sort of ended up doing?
I have lots of interests in life, but there will always be animals in my life. So, you know, I couldn't live my life without my animals.
Did you have like a first particular like animal as your partner on stage who you remember fondly?
Or? Well, I started riding elephants when I was 8, my grandfather's elephants. And they were also my sister and I's babysitters. You know, if my grandparents were busy, we would go in the elephant yard and the elephants really looked after us. They would put their trunk around us and pull us back if we were wandering off to, you know, they were very family. The elephants are, when they're in the family, they're in the family. And
we were in Thailand last year and we were on this elephant sanctuary where all these Thai elephants were, then their mahouts were there because they got them off the streets and now they have a whole school and we were able to ride with their mahout and the elephant. And I was so nervous about it. And obviously you hear so many weird things and it was like the most magical experience. And the elephants are so amazing. We swam with them in the river.
Yeah.
And just the connection they had with their mahout and how secure you felt on there. And I don't know, it was like a life changing moment.
Yeah.
And so it's sad to me that, you know, in New York now it's banned.
Yeah.
And, it's funny because we interview a lot of different people who have various degrees of opinions on animals in the circus. And every time I see an act, especially with you and your animals, there's such a connection there. And they're just so happy to be there and perform and make you happy.
Yeah.
And I grew up riding too. So I had a horse and just like horses are so amazing. And the connection you have with a horse too is just insane. So I'm very jealous of your job.
I have the greatest job in the world,
you
for
really
sure.
Actually, something I wanted to ask about is training horses or dogs. Is every sort of animal kind of different as far as like the kind of animal, or is it all sort of the same kind of principles?
Every single animal is different. And I do work with rescues. And so depending on where the animal came from, what has happened to this animal in the past, I treat everyone absolutely individual. I don't look at them even as a horse or a dog or a pig, you know, it's this individual and what's going on in their head. And
what's like the first step to, once you get an animal, a new animal, can you walk us through what the process basically is of getting that animal to having them in an act?
Hanging out. We're just hanging out. We won't even go into playing, you know, we got to get settled. So I'll stay in if it's a new horse, I'll stay in the stall when I feed them. And just, you know, make sure they know, you know, this is going to be a great relationship. You know, I'm going to give you everything that, you know, lots of goodies and everything that you need to be a strong, healthy animal. And we're going to have fun. And so, it will be weeks before I start any kind of behaviors, and then, you know, build trust and understanding, and then we'll go in and we'll start playing and see what kind of personality I'm dealing with, and is it a playful one, is it a strong one, is it, you know, do they want to show off, do they just want to goof around, do they want to follow, do they want to lead, and so we go from there.
I think you know him. He's in Big Apple, but Christian Stoyanov, who does an act with his chihuahua.
Yeah.
He recently retired his first chihuahua and is now training a new one, Percy. And he was telling me, like, just how different their personalities are and therefore how different the tricks are.
Yeah.
Because what the first dog's name was, Scooby, wanted to do totally different from the tricks that, you know, Percy naturally gravitated towards. Uh-huh. But I assume that's the case for basically all the animals that you have.
Yeah, and it would come down to something even as simple as a sit-up for a dog. Some dogs have a really hard time with that. And people think that it's the easiest trick. You know, everybody can, but it's not true. That some dogs are very uncoordinated and they're back, you know, it's just like, and I've been there and it's like, okay, never mind. You don't have, you know, and sometimes that dog that doesn't want to do a sit, well, Jack is one of them. He's like, I can't do the sit-up, but I'll jump over this hoop, go through this tunnel, do the weaves, you know, I'll dance with you. I'll be, you know, I'll do great heel work, but don't ask me to sit up.
This dog, Jack, that you just mentioned, is, we were talking before we started recording, the best dog. He has the best stage presence.
Yes, yeah.
Just so much energy. So what's his story? When did you get him?
So he was on a Craigslist ad. A farm had two dogs and they had an accident and they were getting rid of, you know, they didn't want these puppies. So I drove up to their farm in the snow on Christmas Day.
Oh my gosh.
2 years ago, and picked up this puppy and aww, brought him home, and so he's been really fun. But what you're seeing, you know, and you're saying how great his personality is, it's taken a lot of work because he is this personality. What you see right now is what he is. But my challenge was during rehearsals and quite a bit into the Lincoln Center run, he was very afraid of the audience.
Oh no.
And so he would come out all happy and then he'd stop in the middle of everything and just look around.
Oh.
You know, and then he'd come back to me and then he would stop and start barking at the audience. Oh. You know, and right, as an animal trainer you just have to, okay, this is, you know, it's never going to be
perfect.
It's not one act I don't think will ever be the same, you know. We have to let them be who they are and work through it or not. You know, it was, there was a time, you know, we were maybe 3 weeks into Lincoln Center and I'm like, maybe this isn't going to work out with him. And that's the way it goes sometimes, you know? But I wanted to pursue it more because he is so happy doing his stuff and now he's really come around and he's almost like showing off to the audience now. So it's fun.
That's actually something I wanted to ask about. You kind of touched on a little bit, but obviously because they're animals and they're your stage partners, they don't always do exactly what is, you know, choreographed or planned to the T. And how do you sort of like work through that on the stage and make the determination like, all right, we're just going to like cut out of this, or I'm going to like wait and see if I can actually get them to do it, or
it's basically, it's really about just being in the moment. I have to be in the moment. I cannot go in there with a plan because they, you know, I don't know what's going to go on in their head and they don't know what's going to go on in their head. I can evaluate a little bit backstage. I know with the horses, okay, this is going to be a hot show. You know, they are ready to go. It's cold outside. You know, they're feeling their oats. Or if, you know, it's 90 degrees in the summer and they've just come in and it's like, okay, I'm going to have to give lots of energy because they're not, you know? So, it really is, you know, each show you don't know and you're just going to, I will work through it. Yeah, it just depends when I get out there. Is he afraid or is he just out of his mind? Like, and then I go from there. Like, okay, if he's afraid, I'm going to spend more time out here. Mm-hmm. I might stop everything and just give him a belly rub and I'll give a lot more treats. We need to work through this and make sure he knows this is a really cool place to be, even when there's, you know, 1,000 people in here.
The horse is so... As I mentioned, I grew up riding horses, and it was actually something that my mom got me into because I had, like, zero self-confidence when I was really little, and I think someone suggested riding, and then I was, like, hooked and had a horse and did the whole showing thing, and, you know, but controlling or just having a partner with one horse in, like, a dressage show, getting her to jump well with me and ride with me and all that was, it took, I don't know, like a whole year to be able to really feel connected to my horse and like where I felt I knew everything about what was going to happen in a show or just even like riding.
Yeah.
And you have an act with like, I don't know, 9 horses.
Oh, it depends on the year. Last year was 18.
Last year was so many horses. Yeah. I was saying that cause there were like the black, the white and the gray and then the little ones, right?
Yeah.
I was, see, I have a good memory. And this year it's,
So this year it's, 6. I've got 3, two Arabs, 2 Frisians, and then the ponies.
Mm-hmm. And they're beautiful horses.
Thank you.
Oh my God. But when you have that many horses out, because I think maybe last year one of them was like over here, like looking at, an audience member. Uh-huh. He was like one of the gray horses. And how do you keep control of, because dogs, I feel like, well, they're little-ish, you know, you can pick them up.
Yeah.
Horses obviously have a mind of their own and they're big animals. And how is it having an act with like 6 horses on stage in a ring where the audience is, you know, 2 feet away?
Yeah. So again, it's really about being in the moment and knowing my animals. You know, if I were one of the kind of trainer that was just handed my whips and I walk in, you know, I would be very vulnerable because I don't know the personalities of these animals. So that's my job, to really understand what I'm dealing with today. And I can get a very good idea of that with 1 circle around the ring. Mm-hmm. And then I know, okay, I have to watch this one. Uh-huh. You know, everybody else is cool.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe that one, you know, and how they're interacting with each other. But it's just about being so in tune. And I think what I learned, maybe too late for me, I wish I would have learned it as a little girl, is to forget about performing. This, first of all, it's about the animals. It's not about me. And I need to be here now with them. I can't be thinking about, you know, and that's why, you know, sometimes I'll run into problems. My costumes are different every year. I need to be comfortable. Right. I cannot be thinking about, you know, anything other than the animals. So, you know, we have that challenge every year. You know, everything has to, my treat pocket has to be reachable. I can't be fumbling around. You know, I really need to focus on these animals and not an audience, not my costume, not are these shoes comfortable, not, you know, like, is this hat going to stay on my head? And so I'll go round and round, you know. Now we're to a place where they really give me a hat, unless it's really on my head, because they know I'm going to, you know, throw a fit, or a wig falling off, you know, all of this stuff. Yeah. And it's stuff that I've learned as I go on.
I feel like your hair color is so iconic in a way. Like when I think of you, I think of like your short blonde hair.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
I don't know if anyone ever said that to you.
It's funny because, for the, you know, most of my childhood and into my 20s, my hair was brown and below my knees. It was this long, you know, and then one day I just decided, okay, enough. And I think it was, you know, the horses too. I just don't have time for this anymore, so I'm cutting it all off.
Cutting it off for the horses.
So would you walk us through like what a typical day for you is, like when you have to wake up and what it's like to feed the animals through the show to you finally being able to go to bed?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So anywhere from 5:30 to 6:30 in the morning is when I get up. And I'll come right to the stables. I have 2 guys that help me backstage, so they're cleaning stalls, and I come right into the ring and I'll start exercising horses right away, and then we'll go into little training sessions. And that all, the training sessions depends on how the show went the day before and what I'm, the new stuff that I'm training. So that all happens 3 or 4 hours in the morning. And then I finish my practice and go right to washing horses. So wash the horses, get them back in their stalls, and then run the dogs. Brush the dogs, clean all of the cages. And by that time I have about 30 minutes to get in the shower, put my makeup on and come for the show.
Wow.
And when the first show is over, hopefully I have practice time, in between before the second show. And then, I'd like to have it that the horses practice in the morning and the dogs in the afternoon. I have to be the dogs need heat because they're very athletic in what they do. So I need to warm them up, and they need heat to practice. So that's kind of the routine that we have. But I might have a couple hours off in the afternoon before we get ready for the next show.
Nice. And so clearly you have more animals than are just in the show this year. I know you have a farm upstate. Could you talk a little bit about that and what the life for the animals in their not performing season is like?
Yeah, sure. So we have 58 acres in the Catskill Mountains. This farm was handed down to me by my grandparents. And so all of my retired animals are there, and that's where we go in the off time with the ones that are working. I'll also alternate, you know, like we were saying, last year I had 18 horses in the ring. This year it's much less, and some of those horses stayed home, some of the ponies stayed home. When we go home in the summer, they're basically out all of the time. They have the option to come in, but they really like to be outside, even when it's cold. If we're getting a major storm, I have to drag them in because they don't want to come in. They don't know what's good for them most of the time. But we have a big barn up there, so we house everybody in the barn when it gets stormy. But
so how many animals in total do you have?
28.
28?
Yeah.
And what are the types of animals that you have?
So horses, Shetland ponies, Welsh ponies, miniature horses. I've got one donkey at home that's retired. I have three more.
Was the donkey in the show like 3 or 4
yes.
years ago?
Yes.
Okay.
Henry.
Yes. Okay.
I have three retired potbelly pigs at home. Plus
there was
the
a pig
one that's here.
Too, right? Three years.
Yeah, she's here this
yeah.
year as well.
But is it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's a big pig, right? It's not a mini pig in the show this year.
Oh no, it's a mini.
Oh, this
pig.
Year.
Yeah,
okay, but
yeah.
she's just the big pig is here.
No, the little pig, the mini pig is
oh,
here.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
And then the three others, and they're all potbelly pigs. But so this is another funny story. The potbelly pigs will get as big as you feed them.
Oh.
And the three that I have at home, I got from a zoo where they had raised them, and they were babies in the zoo. And then people adopted them, but people that didn't know how to care for a potbelly pig. So they came back and they're like, we can't do anything with these pigs. And they were obese, just
massive.
Massive. The fat was falling over their eye.
Oh,
like
no.
It was just a disaster. So I took them and they went on diets. They weren't very happy about that, but we got them back to a manageable weight. But this one that I'm working with here is a potbelly pig. She's 35 pounds.
Oh.
And the three that I have at home are 100 pounds each.
See, this is the misconception, because I thought a potbelly pig was always just big, and then a mini pig was like what it looked like.
No, so a potbelly pig, they're typically pretty small. They're not like those big, you know.
The big honking
yeah,
pigs.
No.
Wow. Shoot, there was a question.
Did you have somewhere, you have like a llama as well, right?
So my porcupine is retired and he's in Florida now with a friend of mine who has exotic animals. So he has his own like den and pool and he's living the life in Florida. And I had a capybara as well.
Mm.
And they're both retired to Florida at the same
warmer
place.
Warmer climates.
So, yeah.
So while you're in New York, do all the animals live on site?
Yeah,
I guess on the square footage of Lincoln Center.
Yeah, so we have stables set up right under the band shell and alongside the band shell, and they're significant stables.
Because we saw the stable area when you guys were playing in D.C.
That's different.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's when we go on tour and that we have the tent and
yep.
and but these are. We could not move these more than 1 year. They're very, they're a real wooden,
oh, nice.
You know, structure
yeah.
with a roof. And,
oh, wow.
So it's, yeah, they're built to withstand snow and rain and wind. And the hurricane we had a few years ago, they didn't move. So they're
good.
Pretty, yeah. yeah.
I guess I was reading an article from when Big Apple Circus basically went into bankruptcy as a nonprofit. What were you going through at that time? Because there's not very many opportunities for animal act, especially with horses.
Mm-hmm.
What was your mindset? What were you thinking about at that time before you knew that it was coming back?
Well, you know, I've been in this business my whole life. I've toured just about every every size circus mm-hmm. in the United States. I've done fairs. I've done, you know, I knew that I'm going to be just fine, mm-hmm. you know. And if I ever question, if I couldn't put all my eggs into one basket, because I'm putting my animals at risk. Mm-hmm. I have to know that, you know, I'm going to be able to support them no matter what. So I wasn't worried about where I'm going to go or what I'm going to do. You know, it's there's always something that I can do. And yeah. I have this beautiful farm at home, and I can even do something there.
I was reading that you were thinking of maybe putting a theater up there.
We are.
That's amazing.
We're going to do that. And it's going to be, it will be multifunctional, but I want to do an animal show for all the skiers at night. And then we've also started a foundation where we're going to bring children with special needs, mm-hmm. seniors. We're going to have autism programs where they can all interact with the animals.
You should have kids who are bullied too. Yes. That was my MO. And then I got into riding and
yes.
now I'm doing a podcast. No. Yeah. I know, I was reading, and Guillaume too, who is his title at the Big Apple as it is now is
our he's consultant.
Consultant. He was the artistic director for many, yes. many years. Yes. And I saw that he is also working on the kind of organization and the theater up in
yes.
New York.
Yeah. So we work together with that. And he'll, when I'm on the road, if someone wants to come and visit the farm, mm-hmm. he'll be there and make the arrangements and bring the ponies out and the pigs and oh just gosh. Have nice individual visits. And then yeah.
Can people like us go?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Come like, on.
Hi. Hello, these animals. I know we're big animal lovers. But you know, training our we were talking about this too, like training our dog is so much work. I don't even know how you find the time. How long does it take to train a new dog, let's say, for an act to get ready?
Well, again, it depends on
the dog.
what their background yep. is, where they're coming from, and what kind of personality they are. And then, you know, I never ever have a plan.
Yeah,
you have to just go with what the dog wants to do, and so that's the key. You know, you can't. It's very difficult to have a structure and say, okay, we're going to do this, and that.
Right.
Maybe he doesn't want to do that. You know,
do you ever get animals that just don't work
yep.
as a performing? Then you just have them.
Yes. Yeah. So I have a border collie that I found this border collie online, and the place looked really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And he was an older dog that didn't sell as a puppy. So they wanted to move him out. And so I said, yeah, I'll come. And I went, and the place was horrifying. And, you know, I'm not against good breeders.
Right.
I'm not against breeding animals, you know,
right.
But there are great breeders out there. Mm-hmm. This place was horrible. And so I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And the guy came to me and I said, okay, so let's see the dog. And so he leaves, he comes back 10 minutes later. I said, that's not the dog that I was looking at. And then he like grumbled and I walked away, and he came back bleeding. Because the dog that now this is the dog that they showed me online bit him, was completely wild. They hadn't, you know, done anything with this dog. They had 50 other dogs there.
50 dogs.
50, at least, oh, yeah. You know, outside, no shelter, no nothing. Then the dog bit me. But he looked at me and I said, I'm taking you away from this. I am not, you know, I couldn't bear it. So I could get critiqued because I gave these people money, but I gave them money. I took the dog. I got in the truck. Before I left the place, I called my USDA inspector and I said, you need to get here. Here's yep. the address. And they were shut down two weeks later, you know.
Well,
and so it.
I think you did good.
Yeah, I think I did good too. And Billy is the result. So Billy is this crazy border collie that I have that travels with me. He is brilliant, like border collies are.
Yep.
But if one person walked in the tent, he runs off. He just can't handle the pressure. So I had another nervous dog. She has been in the show. She's retired now, but she's a Great Dane. Came from a similar situation. It was a big Great Dane breeder. Mm-hmm. They took
great care of their dogs. But she'd never been off the farm before. Oh. And she was another one that did not sell as a puppy. Mm-hmm. So she came to me and she was a little nervous, but I figured out what she really liked to do, and that's run and jump. And so she did it, and she would just run and jump over her hurdles, and then she would leave. She didn't want to stay around, right. You know. But so Billy and her bonded. And they're the greatest of friends. You know, you can't separate them. And so they come down the road, my retired Great Dane and Billy the Border Collie, they're with me all of the time. But they will never, you know, she's retired. He'll never make it into the ring. He's just not. But he's happy, you know, and content. And he has his best friend with him all the time. So.
Is there any kind of animal that's sort of like on your bucket list to train at some point in your life?
All of them. All I mean,
do you have any cats?
Huh?
Do you have any cats?
I used to. About, I think it was 10 years ago. My little sister had two cats, and she was going on the road, and I said, "Well, I'll take them and see what I can do." And one would do her tricks. She was brilliant, but I would have to change her treats all the time because she would get bored, and then it just wasn't interesting enough for her. And the other one did nothing, absolutely nothing. You know, there was just no way. No. So.
Awesome. So maybe we'll wrap up with the three questions we ask all of our guests, unless you have anything else, Lens.
I mean, I could literally just talk about animals all day.
Me too.
But I'm like a massive animal person. I did have a horse once, though, that it's so interesting because, you know, when you're like 15 riding, you don't think about all these you know, things that you're thinking about as an adult, of all the different personality traits, and it's an animal and you have to like learn and work with it. And I just wish there, because I was looking at this horse, his name was Reggie, but he would always jump a little diagonally, mm-hmm. over a jump, and I never felt like so confident, but he was like the sweetest horse. And just like thinking back about my horse riding teachers, and you know, having like a teacher who I think is a more in tune with, like, I don't know, almost approaching it like you do, where like you're not an act, but it is almost like an act when you do a horse show.
Yeah.
And like really taking the time to get to know the horse and not just bop on and take a riding lesson.
That's right. That's
right. You
know,
right. And I like listening to you talk, I'm like, oh gosh, I think I probably could have been a lot better.
Yeah.
As a rider.
Yeah.
And not just focused on me and my posture and how I hold my reins and, you know, all of this stuff. And I'm more like, well, what's the animal doing with me? And I wonder if there's any, yeah, I'm sure there are horse trainers like that, but even when we were in Spain, I made him take a horse riding lesson with me.
Uh-huh.
And in Spain, they're very...
He gave me the tiniest little horse. And they see this beautiful, massive...
Yeah, the beautiful, big horse. And Josh had this, like, tiny little squat. Like,
so, but his horse, I can't ride, though, which is why.
Yeah, they're like, you're a beginner. But, you know, even there, it's so much about your posture and how you hold the reins. And I don't even know if she really ever was, like, listened to the horse. Because I didn't, like, ever really... I thought about the horse, obviously, because I'm like, I want her back.
Yeah.
But it's interesting hearing all that, and like from my background, I think it probably would be better to approach it like you did.
It's funny because my grandparents, I grew up on that farm, and I started riding ponies when I was 5 years old, probably. Yeah. But I was taught to first, when you first start riding, you ride bareback.
Yeah.
You can feel them.
Yep.
You feel, so you have a much better chance if you can stay up there.
Yeah. That and, was the best thing, though. When I was riding with my pony bareback through just like open woods was the best. And that's after we like really bonded, and I was like, oh man, I trust her so much.
Yeah.
That's true.
You're far more connected. You know, you know what's going on. And also when I was growing up, we didn't have a lot of money. I didn't have, you know, we didn't have the means to buy the riding boots and all of the trinkets that go with, you know, the horse world, all of this stuff, you know, to this day, I don't know when I'm looking at a saddle or a bridle. I don't know when I'm like, you know, this one works. I'll take that. And often, you know, a lot of my childhood, I didn't have a bridle. I had a halter, and I would put, you know, a rope on either side of the halter. It's because
it really is about the connection and the relationship. You know, that's how you're going to learn how to ride. Later, you can sit up a little straighter if you want or whatever. Right. But that shouldn't be the yes. You can't post bareback.
No, you gotta. It's just about staying on.
And you really learn how to ride a horse when you're riding bareback. You really learn how to ride a horse. So Grandma's first test, she ran. She had pony camp at that farm for years, and a lot of kids would come from New York City, and maybe they've had riding lessons. And she said, "Okay, so you can ride. You're confident. You're a very good rider. Okay, we're gonna take these stirrups off now, and you're just gonna sit and." Nobody could do it.
Really?
Nobody could do it. Yeah.
So I guess my trainer must have been better. Well, I loved her. Like, she was like one of my, you know, as a child and an adult, she was like an amazing person in my life. She made me ride bareback a lot.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's the way to do it. Because then you're really for real.
So Josh, next time.
Yeah, next time we'll do a bareback. I guess one thing before we do the last three questions. Say tonight there's a 5-year-old girl or boy who's sitting in the front row or second row who sees your act and is like, oh my God, that's going to be me. It's what I want to do. How does somebody get into learning about animals, animal training? Like, what are the first steps somebody can take?
It depends on where they are, and what's happening. But just go out. You just have to have the most positive attitude and don't ever give up. Go to this place. If this place isn't working, go to another place. Go to a zoo and get a job. Even if you're volunteering at a shelter, just get involved with animals. Be hands-on. Don't be afraid. You know, get in there and do it. And I've said this, you know, when people have asked training advice, don't think so much. Just go. Just do it. Just jump in and do it. Get in there with that animal and interact and get to know each other, however you can. So if you want to make it to the circus ring, the first thing is, you know, go volunteer at a shelter, clean out cages every day, because this is a lot of work. You know, that goes. It's a beautiful thing to share the ring with these animals and you know, I love showing off how beautiful they are, but it takes a lot of work to make them beautiful.
When you say you have to bathe all the horses, like, oh my God, that's right.
Yeah.
And brush them and all the
dogs. Oh, and when it's cold, it's baby wipes. Right. White horses and baby wipes because it's too cold. Right. So but that's when you know, if you're passionate in 14 degrees and you want to go out and spend time, you know, with these animals, okay, you're going to make it.
Yeah.
You're going to make it in there. You know, you'll find your way, but it's just getting out there and going for it.
So we ask three questions to every guest. And the first one being, has there been a piece of advice, really good or really bad, that has stuck with you, like, throughout your life?
Oh, there's so much. But it's being in the moment. Be in the moment with this animal. Forget about the audience. Forget about your costume. Forget about, you know, I'm not here posing. I'm not thinking about how I'm going to style, how I'm going to, you know, how the music is working, following me. It's right here, this really magical moment with this amazing animal. Just suck it all in, you know, take it all in. Enjoy this moment. Enjoy this moment.
Great. The second question is, other than Big Apple Circus, is there a circus that you would recommend, or a show, or it could be a movie about circus or a book about circus, that you would recommend to somebody who is getting into it or passionate that they see or experience?
Hmm. Oh, there's so many that... Okay, so shows. I would go to Europe. I would make a tour.
Knee, oh my God, the horse act?
Yes.
Knee.
Yeah.
And then the lights go off? And they're all like going in separate directions. They have the lights on their bridles and their harness.
Yes. It's so amazing. So that's what I would, you know, if you're into animals, you know, a show like Kani, where it's, we still have the dirt ring. The dirt ring is just precious to me. You know, it really shows that the show respects the horses because they need that. So any show, any circus with a dirt ring is all right by me. They love their horses. And Alexi Gruss too is another one that's all about horses. And so
Kavalia, right? It's all a whole horse show too.
Yes, yeah, that's really amazing. Ten. Yes, if we're talking just horses, then Cavalia is the place to go get inspired.
And our last question is, who do you think we should have on the podcast?
I love our announcer.
Stephanie. Yes. I know. We had Keith on.
Okay.
So we have to, I know we could have done a whole day of just interviewing everyone.
Uh-huh.
Actually, Mike Richter was like, you should just do a whole day and just have everyone. And Mark Gindick, Texas, was like, what? You're not interviewing me? We have all of you that we still have to interview. But yeah, Stephanie would be great.
She's so interesting. And she has such a positive vibe to her, and
she does.
And but also she sort of, this is her first season here, she's new, you know, there's a lot of us that have been here a long time, and she is almost taking the role of like Mother Goose, you know, like right. she looks after us, she asks everybody how they're doing today, how, you know, so she's just gold. This woman is great. Just gold.
I wish she did a whip act in the show.
Yes.
Next year. Next year. That's our request. Next year, Stephanie, do a whip back. Please, thanks.
Jenny, thank you so much for talking to us. It was such a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Yeah, best of luck with the rest of the season. Hope we get to come up to the Catskills and see your farm.
Oh, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful, yes.
And that was our interview with Jenny Vidbell.
If you like our podcast, make sure to follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter tweet us. Subscribe on iTunes.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right. We're everywhere now. And, you know, email us at hello@howtowaycircus.com. Have a good weekend. Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.